why aren't people, as a matter of course, changing their homes into places that are functionally places where people can age with dignity and in safety?
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
My name is Marcy Rogo. I'm on the board of At Home with Growing Older. Susie and I came up with this radio hour in order to sort of take a play on KQED and have a fun non-Zoom format that would be accessible to anyone with a phone. Just something fun to do on Thursday nights as we all enjoy our nightcap, our dinner. And before I introduce Lewis, I just wanted to let everyone know that this is our very first At Home on Air. Thank you again to everyone that was able to donate. You know, right now without our forums and in-person events, it's not as easy to raise funds, so we super appreciate it. With that, let's introduce Lewis. So I have a few words to say about our very special guest. Lewis is a friend of mine and just an incredible role model. He has been advocating for aging in place since the 80s or earlier. In 1988, he was remodeling a paraplegic friend's house to be more independent. He was a carpenter, and he had no idea that this was going to change his entire life and focus for his career. From there, he really started making aging in place a true concept in the 90s. He'll speak about that in a few. At some point, 20 years later, he was able to release a really, really well-known white paper. I don't know if you have all seen Aging in Place 2.0, Rethinking Solutions to the Home Care Challenge, that was published by MetLife, the Insurance Marketing Institute. And he's also the founder of Homes Renewed, which is a super exciting coalition of businesses, consumers, and nonprofit stakeholders driving policy and investment to increase the number of age-friendly homes. It's one of the nation's leading authorities on aging in place, which is no surprise because he is based in Washington, D.C. So yeah, without further ado, Lewis, Mr. Tenenbaum, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Ms. Rogo. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really honored to be included.
Well, just pick it off. I've heard this from you, but I think people would really enjoy to hear the sort of milestones from your journey, from that carpenter role all the way till today, sort of what shaped that and what you've seen change over the years.
Well, I finished college in 76 and wanted to build my own solar house. So to my father's incredible dismay, I got a job on a construction site after I graduated from college and worked my way up to being a carpenter and built some solar stuff, a hippy-dippy carpenter in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then moved to the D.C. area. And in 1988, as you said, I got involved in renovating this house for a young man who was paraplegic. His mother, when I asked her why she needed a carpenter, she said, well, I didn't help him in the bathroom before he was injured, and I don't want to help him in the bathroom when he gets out of rehab. And, you know, 88, way pre-internet, there was no real information, but I took the challenge and renovated their bathroom. I would have done it differently, but he was independent in the bathroom. And I saw the incredible significance, the value that his ability to be independent for that family. He wasn't the kid who needs help with everything. He was just himself. And I was totally turned on by what I was able to do with my tools for that kid and that family. Then I read an article about the age wave a year or two later and said, wow, there's an opportunity there. There's a niche I can carve out for myself to help people age, and I can do some of the stuff that was so much fun and brought me so much pleasure. So I started out looking and joined the community of people, businesses, and agencies serving older citizens in the community in Montgomery County, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. And after some hiccups about being accepted, most people kind of thought that a contractor was really planning to prey on older homeowners, older consumers. After a while, they got to be trusting me. And by the mid to late 90s, I was teaching about this stuff under some grants from the Administration on Aging around the country and teaching classes for home builders and occupational therapists. And from then until now, still the same question remains, which is, if this is such a good idea, why aren't more people doing it? Why is it a struggle? Why aren't people, as a matter of course, changing their homes into places that have this universal design idea, but are functionally places where people can age with dignity and in safety? I worked as a contractor doing a lot of work for people with disabilities, people with spinal cord injuries, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, ALS, Coast Polio Syndrome. Got a lot of experience, attended conferences. Like, I remember when Valerie Fletcher was running a big universal design conference in Providence, Rhode Island. And aging in place has always been kind of a peripheral issue in some respects to universal design. They're very connected, but aging in place is the larger issue. And the universal design is also a large issue. They're connected, but they're not the same thing. Aging in place really is an extension of the fact that we have this miracle of longevity, of increased life expectancy. The founding of this country, life expectancy was 32. By the time Social Security was started in 1935, life expectancy was just 61. By the time Medicare started in 1965, life expectancy was 71. But the really important part is, now that we've reached a point where life expectancy is easily 79 to 85 for many people, the fact is that our physical condition starts to change in the late 70s. And what was good design for people who didn't have these changes in their mobility no longer is such good design. The function of our home kind of leaves us in the dark. It's not working for us as well. About 10 or 15 years ago, I really sort of burned out on being a building contractor and decided to focus myself on consulting and advocacy around these issues. And a few years ago, I really got the idea that we need to be a political force and to demonstrate the value of better home design as the community of the United States of America, and in fact, the world, really starts to exhibit life expectancy and the mobility issues that come with it. How's that for an intro?
Oh, it's great. I love it. That was sort of my next question. You know, there's a reason I think that you must have decided Homes Renewed was necessary and policy was necessary. Were people just not listening? Was there no support for these kind of changes? What was missing and what is still missing, you know, in our society that's keeping this from happening?
Oh, I think there's a balance of two things. I think that largely we don't recognize the issue. It's out of sight, it's out of mind. Human beings don't plan very well. I mean, when the airlines had a business going, they did a really great job of raising the rates about 2 weeks before everybody's vacation. And we had to make our reservations. I mean, people are slow to make plans. People expect not to need things like this. So there are those things, the sort of general human behavior. It's new. The building industry is a little stodgy. We like to do things the way we've done them before because we know they work. But also, some research came out a few years ago from an outfit called the Frameworks Institute. And it's really the basis of a lot of anti-ageism stuff that's going on. But what I really read from their work is that the general population thinks that they don't have much control over their aging process. They think it's a combination of genetics and luck. And we know, people who study this, that that's really not true, that people can have a lot of impact on their own aging from exercise, from healthy eating, from social contact, from remaining social and using our brains. But because most people don't think that's the case, they think it's this combination of genetics and luck, when they hear something that says, oh, you should do better, you should do more, you can have control, they tune it out. You know, a lot of us often, and we're seeing this across the country right now, people tune out real information that changes the way they think. And I think that's part of it. But on the flip side of that, we see that incentives, small financial incentives, really do change people's behavior. So in my area, we have a 5-cent tax or charge for grocery bags, for example. Now, at one point in time, and often, I pay most things with a debit card, right? I think a lot of people do nowadays, or a credit card. And on the rare occasion that for some reason I pull out cash and spend it and they give me back a nickel and change, I don't really want the nickel. I want to have one of those little things that you could put a penny in there or put a nickel in there for somebody else. I don't want the nickel in my pocket. I don't have a use for a nickel. I don't want to carry them around. But then all of a sudden you charge me a nickel, the same nickel for a bag. And I run out to my car with my arms full, or I run back out to my car and get my bag if I've forgotten it. So there's something about that incentive process that's really significant in terms of behavior change. We see it also in smoking. You know that you get a break on your health insurance because you don't smoke. You know that you get a break on your car insurance if you don't have tickets. A couple of years ago, my son was here and we ended up getting a late start to the airport. And I was really driving too fast. And I admit it, we weren't talking about what the consequences would be if he missed his plane. But what was really on my mind was, if I got a ticket, what would happen to my insurance rate? I didn't really care about getting the ticket and he would miss his flight, but I was really concerned about my insurance rate. So there's all kinds of things like this that influence our behaviors. You know, those yellow Energy Star tags in the store, we think about that. I know out in California, at least in Southern California, you have tax breaks if you do rain water-saving gardening. Many places that were federal, and there still are federal, but also state incentives to put solar collectors on your roof. So people do it. Solar collectors were available before the tax credits, but the tax credit really pushes people over the edge. I was actually riding a bus back from New York City from giving a presentation on universal design, reading an article on urban planning. And I realized that everything I was seeing around me was based on an incentive, a policy decision that we as a society had made about what we felt was important. So whether it's funding the Kennedy Center or the school system or the sewage treatment plant or the highways, we fund these things because we decide we care. And I decided that in the same way, we need to help people to understand that we need to care about this and fund it, and that if we can incentivize this uptake, this changing, updating of our houses, that we could start to have real impact on how many houses were prepared. And in that way, we could have an impact on what the health costs are for older people, because we know they're high, but we also have pretty good inkling, if not actual evidence, that they can be lower as people live in a safer home. And that it also is about the dignity and choices that someone gets to make by maintaining their self-esteem in their own home that they love. Mm.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's so much to dig into here with behavioral change and the carrot versus the stick model. It sounds like a very realistic and aligned possibility that healthcare companies should provide refunds or incentives for changing the home, given that a fall is so expensive for the healthcare company. In my family, the marble floors, didn't want to cover them. It cost too much money. Guess who fell on the marble floor and broke their hip? And that was the beginning of the end of life, right? That's how it happens a lot. So the insurance company would have saved a lot of money. Are those the kind of conversations you're having?
You know, insurance companies are really funny. I've learned a lot. I've been going to long-term care insurance conferences and trying to figure my way into the Medicare Advantage plan. Insurance companies are really reluctant to do things that doesn't have an evidence base. And the evidence on this stuff, it's intuitive, but the evidence is not there that home modifications really save healthcare dollars. There's very little evidence. The CAPABLE study from Johns Hopkins is the only one that gets a lot of coverage. And it is really based on people of lower income with severe illness. And that's where you get into some part of the problem here. The fact is that most of the calls that you get if you're a contractor dealing with this are at time of crisis. And if you have any experience in the building business, I know Susie is an architect, it doesn't happen on a dime. the discharge planning process. You fall down, they glue your hip back together, and they're ready to pop you back out a week later or something like that. Well, discharge planning process doesn't really dovetail very well with the process of remodeling a home. It takes time to make decisions. It takes time to line up subcontractors and order materials and get the things done well and get permits and get drawings. It's hard to do at the last minute, which is when most of the calls come in. So what we really need is to move this upstream to a time frame that is about updating your house in a way that's not connected to health. And that is very difficult, to disconnect this from health.
Yeah, that has come up so often. How can we ever get people to proactively do something like this? Because nobody wants to think about their own mortality. It's really mind-blowing. If any progress can be made on this, that's going to be amazing. But for those people who do want to be proactive, what would you tell them to do that are the most important things that you could do for your home if you want to age safely there?
The most important things are being able to get in and out safely in any weather, day or night. And that is a combination of safety from elements in your neighborhood or your community that might scare you, but also good stairs if you have stairs, or no stairs if you could get there, good railings, a decent light, lighted path from the car to the door, a light on the lock mechanism, a lever handle, which is easier to operate than a knob that you have to have a good grip to turn. So getting in and out is one. Moving around within the house, which is also about lighting, good switching, and not necessarily brighter lighting, because bright lighting can cause glare. And particularly as our eyes age, bright lights can be more glare producing than they are when you're younger. So lighting, maneuvering spaces, railings on the paths that you take through your house, pick up those throw rugs and other things, clear paths. A dear friend of mine's sister fell just the other day and bumped her nose, maybe broke her nose, because she had a box in the hallway that she was planning to take down to the post office, and she forgot about it and tripped over it. So keeping our paths clear, getting into the bathroom and the bedroom and being able to access all the activities in those rooms, which includes storage, you know, your closet, your dresser, the medicine chest, the extra TP that's underneath or in a linen closet, getting into and out of your bed, using the tub and the shower safely, using the toilet, using the sink. Now, a lot of people, the only time they really lift one leg high off the ground is when they're climbing into the tub. And if you're holding onto the curtain or the glass door, those things weren't designed to give you a grip. So you need to have good grips that are well installed and in the right places. Most of us are often familiar with grab bars in the hotel room, right? And what you get in the hotel usually is a grab bar, a long grab bar on the far side of the tub. Well, if you can lean over that far and grab that, then maybe it can help you get in. But when you're wet and you've pulled back that curtain and you're about to climb out, do the flamingo, really stand on one leg and lift the other leg really high to come out, that grab bar is behind you. That's not the right place for the grab bar. The grab bar needs to be probably vertical near the edge of the tub so that you can grab it when you're going in and grab it when you're going out.
Yeah, I've even almost broken bones in back of the hotel rooms. It's often so hard. What were they thinking when they made this?
And part of that is that this isn't a natural way of thinking. These things aren't natural. The idea of having grips all around us is not natural. But I have a picture in my slide deck of a 3-year-old standing in a bathroom with a grab bar. And you know what? He holds on. I mean, it's natural to hold on to something, but it's not natural for us to think about falling. And even at the sink in the bathroom, you know, are you leaning over? Is it hard to lean over to spit in the sink? Do you have trunk control and balance control? Is there something to grip nearby? Is the lighting pretty good there? Then the kitchen, similarly, can you sit in the kitchen? Why does Thanksgiving mean sore feet to most people? Why can't we have a place where you can sit in the kitchen and do your chopping and cleaning? Why don't we have a rolling cart in the kitchen so we can set the table by moving the dishes out on a cart and clear the table on that same cart instead of making a lot of trips back and forth with a couple of things in our hand? So making meals, taking meals, doing the home office function is really important. Do you have a safe place where you can sit and work your computer or do your mail and stuff? Or are you using a rolling chair that has a chance of scooting out from under you? I'm not sure what's better, but just think about those things. And then how do you work your entertainment? Is your TV easy to get to? Is your music, is the lighting really light and the grips nearby to get to your comfy chair to do reading? How do you entertain guests? One thing that's really important for me anyway, because I like to exercise a lot and be outside, is how do you enjoy the outdoors? How do you get to the outdoors? How is it accessible for you and safe for you to take sun or work in your garden or get a walk near your home?
People, when they hear this, you know, think, yes, yes, but these things, oh, they're so ugly or they look so dreary. They're for, quote, old people. I don't want those in my home. What say you to them? Are the designs around us changing? Are there resources that make this more palatable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's becoming common now. The curbless shower, called the Euro shower, and good-looking grab bars from Europe and the United States that have style to them and match the whole kind of core of the bathroom. Not stainless steel anymore. If you're going with colors, you can have warm and hot colors. Some of the European grab bars with plastic coatings are really nice, but they match the other fixture pieces in the bathroom, toilet paper holder and stuff. They're all the same design now. So it's a design package that includes some of these safety items, but there is still a reluctance on the part of the people selling this stuff to mention it because it's stigmatized. People don't want to talk about it. No kitchen and bath salesperson or contractor wants to lose the sale because they start to suggest that you should have grab bars. You know, they're just afraid to say it. So it doesn't get said. We're talking about home safety, but what if instead of the yellow Energy Star tag, everything that received an incentive from your insurance company or from the federal government, in fact, had a purple tag on it. Like the Energy Star label that's yellow, it had a purple tag. And that purple tag indicated a product that saves you money, that there's an incentive associated with that product. Now you're going down the aisle at the high-end bath store or at the Home Depot or Lowe's, and you see an aisle that says, these products are purple tag. They qualify for a tax break or an insurance company break. You know, it's kind of like silver sneakers. Going to the gym is now pretty high-end because silver sneakers, it's associated with your health insurance. Your gym membership is associated with your health insurance. That changes the conversation. And in the same way, the purple tag that says this is an incentivized product, not an old people product, it's not a safety product, it's an incentivized product that saves you money.
That makes total sense to me, and that's the way I hope that we go. To shift gears for just a moment, COVID is obviously what we're all living through right now. There are a lot of people that are stuck at home that are isolated. How do you think, if anything, is COVID going to change the impact of our ability to stay in our homes? Is the world going to be different? Is there something good that could come out of this by teaching us to connect even if we're in our homes? It doesn't even have to be about aging in place. Like, just curious about how you see a post-COVID world and how it's affecting us all.
I mean, I have a client right now, a design client, that has just called the contractors off. The husband in this household has multiple sclerosis. He's immunocompromised, taking lots of medication. They've been working for months getting ready to remodel their house, and they just said, no, we're not going to expand our bubbles by allowing people in the house. I think we're going to see immediate reactions about the proximity. When people are remodeling your house, they're right in there with you. When you're making selections, you're leaning over the same table, looking at stuff with other people. So that's one thing. But I think with the really unfortunate parts of COVID, we're seeing that the assisted living, the nursing home, is no longer the haven. It's no longer the safe place. In fact, it's sort of the worst place. You can't keep the staff from going in and out and dealing with their own families. Our worst hotspots have been congregate living for older people. So that's really, I think, going to change our feelings about it and has the not quite silver lining opportunity to raise the idea of safety and security in our own homes. That's what we're doing right now. We're all at home trying to be safe, trying to feel secure. But if that home is still also a place where you're in danger of falling, then that safety and security is compromised. I think this does give us an opportunity to raise this issue and to discuss it with people from a different vantage point, because we all have a different vantage point now. So that's number one. Number two is that I think there's a real training and work opportunity in remodeling homes that will help us get the economy started again, possibly, when we feel safe and comfortable allowing workers in our homes. But number three is really fascinating. So you've heard the term flatten the curve, right?
Oh, yeah. That's the term of the moment.
The term of the moment. Well, and if you think really about what we're talking about in terms of aging in place, it's really the same thing. So the idea with flattening the curve is to reduce the need for acute care in order to not overwhelm the hospital system, right? Well, isn't that what aging in place is about? If you help people avoid injury, help people avoid the fall in a well-designed home, it's easier for people to come home and not stay in rehab as long, because you can get in the door and get your shower and so forth. That in fact, if our homes are updated, it will reduce the impact, the cost, the need, and the misery associated with falls and other acute conditions associated with aging, and essentially flatten the curve of this big, huge surge of population of older people that are about to overwhelm the hospital system.
Yeah, and I think we can even take that another level to COVID, where real behavior change, there's obviously a lot of things you need in the models, but you know, one of them is awareness. People weren't starting to change their behavior, but they did it sure fast once they saw people dropping dead in other countries. And so what people would need and require is the awareness of dropping. Maybe you don't die when you fall, but your life sure changes after that. It's interesting to see that it's possible. I mean, the behavior change we've seen in the past 2 months is unprecedented. With your lobbying, with coalitions like yours, with continuing to push this and get the message out there, I think the more people that become aware, the more this will become normalized, and that people will change their behavior to avoid such a uncomfortable and bad aging situation. But on that note, I want to make sure we open it up to our wonderful audience.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
Joanne Cannell, I'm a kitchen and bath designer, and a lot of my clients just give up the tub in order to have easy access to get in and out of a shower. And I just point out, if you want to stay here as long as possible, it's good to make it accessible and easy to use. If they have relatives that visit that might have disabilities, if they have an accident, sometimes I recommend backing around a shower or a tub so grab bars can be added later if needed. And also in a shower, it should definitely be a thermostatic valve, which lets you really control the temperature so you don't get scorched in the shower. And it's safer for children too.
Right. Can bring also in those other things. So it's not just about them.
There's guidelines from the National Kitchen and Bath Association. You can find them online, and they have acceptable guidelines and just general guidelines. There's a lot of that information there. But also, like the glare, having contrast helps people. If parts of a wall are lighter and darker below, or a trim around the edge, to help them get oriented. So there's a lot of things to consider. Storage, you want to not have to bend down too low. You don't want to have to reach up too high. And you want pull out so things are more accessible.
Yeah, it's a long list of things. If you're not a professional in the space, you wouldn't just know. And Lewis, is that being true to you?
Yeah, I like patterns in the floor and near the edging of counters and showers and stuff to help with the contrast.
Hi, I'm Beth McLeod. There's some real extensive thinking here. I really appreciate what you told us. From your work, do you know of anybody who has tried to run the numbers on how increased safety in the home can reduce the numbers of calls to the police and fire department? If they have programs like San Francisco Police Department, but their attention is on security around the home, like lighting, to reduce break-ins, if people are incentivized, perhaps cities could be incentivized to get these inspections done and then reduce the numbers of calls to the police and fire department due to falls.
I don't have a memory of that, but I think it's a really neat idea, Beth. I'll talk to our team about that idea. The fire people and so forth could be a coalition stakeholder to do some pilot studies to come up with this type of data. I think it's a really interesting data point to look for.
Yeah, Beth, it's a great question and comment. Thanks for your contribution there. Very good angle.
Rains Cohen. I'm calling Sheltering Out of Place in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lewis, you had some really active legislative advocacy going back a couple of years. I'm just wondering what the state and plans are around that, especially now that people are getting a newfound appreciation for spending time at home, especially isolated without networks of support and family at hand. Is there new potential? Is there new directions for the Institute?
I think a little bit. Most aging policy is focused on people who are either very poor health or have very few resources. So we're trying to help shift the focus to middle income people and prevention. There have been some federal bills for a tax credit, but they're pretty expensive. There are some things going on in different places around the country, and some of them are listed on our website. But those things going on around the country, which I view as kind of a laboratory for what might work, what messaging might work. We're working on a combination of earned income tax credit and possible zero penalty use of existing retirement savings. So this is already your money in your 401k or IRA that we could possibly encourage you to use to do those sorts of things. The money that doesn't come in from the taxes and so forth would offset the Medicare costs of falls and other things. So that's kind of our angle in terms of things that are new that are going on. We see that in the past year, Senator Angus King from Maine has had a bill that went through that's going to be tracking a little more information over time. This fall, Senate Special Committee on Aging had fall prevention hearings. And at the end of those hearings, Susan Collins, the chair of that committee, said, you know, this is really important and has an impact on people's lives. It's not like Alzheimer's, where we have to figure out what the cause is. We have to figure out how to cure it and treat it. This is simple, and it's not expensive. So that's what our coalition is about, is building a coalition of stakeholders, consumers, businesses, other interest groups that can see that there is a relatively inexpensive way to add dignity, make aging more economical, and now we can also say, and flatten the curve of the oncoming large population of older Americans.
This is Susie Stadler. I have a question, Lewis. You know, the majority of the American housing stock is existing private homes, but there's also a lot of new residences going up. And I wonder if you have any idea how we could incentivize both builders and homeowners to integrate inclusive design and lifelong homes into this thinking of new home construction.
I think it's really important. Any of these things we're talking about should apply to new homes. In Montgomery County, Maryland, where I live, we have the Design for Life Montgomery program, which applies to new homes or renovations, the same sort of tax credit. In some cases, the builder or developer passes it on to the homeowner. So, for example, if there are products in a new home that would qualify for a tax incentive, grab bars, slip-resistant tile, and so forth, when installed correctly, those things could be listed with the sale of the house. The purchaser could take advantage of those tax incentives for that portion of the home building cost. Certainly, new homes should be leading the trend.
It would be the easy place to start.
Well, it would be. I spent a lot of time consulting to the 50-plus active adult housing world, and those builders would always say, listen, we'll do it when our clients ask for it. Now, the clients will ask for it when there's an incentive, and when that incentive can be passed on, it's very simple for the builder to just include in the bill of sale, these products that we use have the purple tag associated with them, however the incentive works, and then the client gets to apply that expenditure to the tax break. The reason I don't concentrate on new housing, even though it's obviously a clear idea, clear path, is that we have, you know, as you said, 100 million houses in this country right now. And in the best of years, the building industry builds 1 million new ones. Now, those 1 million new ones, I 100% agree, should be built to inclusive design or universal design or age-friendly design or whatever standards we decide to use. You know, there's a really good standard out in Rogue Valley, Oregon, the lifelong housing standard. That should apply. But until we start to apply these ideas to existing homes, we're not going to have the impact on, you know, medical cost savings that we need to have.
Maybe in the long run, this will actually increase the value of a home if it's built this way and adapted this way. It struck me when you said that nursing homes or retirement homes are sort of not the safe places anymore. So maybe this increases the value of a home in the long run.
That's been a really great thing. People always go, well, what does it do? Does it ruin the value of a home? And you know, Marcy mentioned the idea that most of us have an image of an unattractive hospital bathroom or something like that. And I'm telling you, as I told many of my design clients over the years, I'm never going to do a bathroom for you that isn't magazine worthy. And I'm sure that's the thing for any of the designers engaged in this stuff. We want this stuff to be beautiful, and it often is. It's often the hottest looking bathrooms and kitchens that you see. But it's important that to make that the trend, it has to look good. And if it looks good, it will sell. But now the problem is that house can get lost in the marketplace unless we designate it somehow that it's accessible. And does that shoot the sale in the foot? So there's some controversy here. And the next thing is when it's being marketed and when it's being counted as looking for more value in the sale price, who determines what the level of accessibility or the fact of accessibility is? I had a client a few years ago who was looking for a wheelchair accessible house, and one was listed on the market. So we made an appointment with the realtor and went over there and looked at the house. There were steps to get in. There was a narrow hallway in the house to get to the one bathroom on the main level. I looked at the realtor and didn't say, why are you wasting my time? I said, what makes you think this is a wheelchair accessible house? And he said, well, the old guy who was living in this house before he died, before it went on the market, slept in a bed in the living room. He used a wheelchair and a bedside commode. That's how he decided that it was an accessible house. So until we start to have these things on the multi-listing service or Zillow and some generally acceptable standards, it's impossible to market these homes, and it's impossible to start counting what the real estate value is in the sale. It's another part of our battle to make this a good idea. One thing I often say to people is there's always people looking for accessible houses. If you do this to your house, it'll be the only accessible one on the block, maybe, and it will be the one that the right people want very badly when it goes on the market.
I believe that. My parents are in real estate, and when there are homes that are one story that have a good layout, they're always, always desired. Whether it's people in their 30s who want to never move again and want to stay there the rest of their lives, or people that are needing to downsize but don't want to go into an apartment, those houses always, always go quickly. That's maybe just the LA market. So I should put that in there, anecdotal.
Thank you. I appreciate your answer, Luis.
Sure. I appreciate the question, Susie. This is fun.
My name's Rachel. I always thought it would be a really good idea for realtors to have an age-friendly design score. By merely having that as a rating system, it would increase the value. People feeling like, wow, that's even more valuable. It has a 9 out of 10, you know, on the accessibility scale. And where we live, like, houses are often quickly staged and prepared before they're ready to sell again. And so I often wonder, like, that right there is a time and opportunity for people to make age-friendly decisions and then be able to say this house is walkable and it's age-friendly. I don't know who would make that designation, but
it's a good idea.
I think that would be great. But then also you talked about how the design has to look good to be a trend. And I was just wondering how in popular culture people can see really beautiful.
There are books that come out occasionally on this topic. What I do is I go to Howe and I put in universal design. I put in curdless shower, multi-threshold shower, and some good looking stuff comes up. So people are putting it in there, but it's kind of the same problem. The terminology can be troublesome. It's like picking the name of a rock band. Some people like Ace Friendly, some people don't like Ace Friendly. Some people like universal design, some people like inclusive design. Some people like just good design. We haven't yet reached kind of a consensus, but I would say that one of the premier, there's two, there's the Better Living Design Institute, which is run out of North Carolina by a dear friend of mine named Richard Duncan. And then there is the Rogue Valley, Oregon Lifelong Housing Program. It's a county program, I think, in Rogue Valley, Oregon. The contact person up there is a woman named Connie Saldana. In your area, in the Bay Area, kind of the Bay Area, Eskaton, which was a senior, you know, is a big provider of, I think, really wonderful senior housing communities in that area. They had a program for a few years, but they couldn't make it work. I mean, this isn't for lack of try. As Marcy said, I've been at this a while, as has Valerie Fletcher and Richard Duncan and lots of other people. Most of us are just nutcases who can't let go, you know, like we're a dog with a bone. A lot of really good ideas have come and gone, but it could be that the time is right now. I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I mean, this was a great starting statement, Louis, that now is the time. So let's hope that it's true. My last question for you is, how can we contribute to your efforts?
Well, the best way is at the homesrenewedcoalition.com website. Go there, look around, join the coalition. It's not expensive. There's multiple levels. That's one way, money and stuff. But if you want to work on this with us, write me an email. Lewis@homesrenewed.org. There's also a homesrenewed.org site. That's our nonprofit research-oriented site. We're doing some research projects, applying for some grants. We can use all the help we can get, and we can use all the friends we have.
This is the greatest note to end on, for sure. Lewis, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Marcy and Susie, and everyone else who joined, because we need to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. Thank you to our sponsor, the Walnut Foundation, a San Francisco family foundation. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.